the zealous leader of Gansu province enthused. From start to finish, the chairman criticized rightist conservative thinking. Mao set the tone on the opening day of the meeting. "Don't mention this term, opposition to rash advance, again, all right? This is a political problem. Any opposition would lead to disappointment, and 600 million discouraged people would be a disaster." Over several days, Mao repeatedly lost his temper as he badgered the planners, accusing them of pouring cold water on the enthusiasm of the people and holding back the country. Those guilty of opposing rash advance were a mere 50 meters away from the rightists. Wu Lengzi, editor of the People's Daily, which had published the critical editorial on the 20th of June, 1956, was at the very top of the list of leaders summoned by Mao. The chairman's verdict? Vulgar Marxism, vulgar dialectics. The article seems to be anti-leftist as well as anti-rightist. But in fact it is not anti-rightist at all, but exclusively anti-leftist. It is sharply pointed against me. Huge pressure was applied to the assembled leaders, and even for hardened men accustomed to the rigours of party life, the stress was soon to prove too much. Huang Qing, chairman of a commission responsible for technological development and former husband of Mao's wife, collapsed after the chairman took him to task. Lying in bed, staring at the ceiling and mumbling incomprehensibly, he gave the doctor a bewildered look, begging for forgiveness. "Save me! Save me!" Put on a plane for medical treatment, he fell to his knees to kowtow before Li Fuchun, who was accompanying him to Guangzhou. Placed in a military hospital, he jumped through a window and broke a leg. He died in November 1958, aged 47. But the real target for Mao's ire was Chou Enlai. On the 16th of January, Mao brandished in front of the premier a copy of Kurt Xingxi's The New Shanghai Rides the Wind and Breaks the Waves, accelerating the construction of socialism. "Well, Enlai, you are the premier. Do you think you could write anything as good?" he asked scornfully. "I couldn't," the premier muttered, straining to absorb the attack. Then, after the ritual of public humiliation, came the blow. "Aren't you opposed to rash advance?" "Well, I am opposed to opposition to rash advance." A number of leftist party leaders joined the fray. Kurt Xingxi and Li Jingxuan, the radical leader of Sichuan, tore into the premier. 3 days later, Zhou made a lengthy speech of self-criticism, taking full responsibility for the reversal in 1956, admitting that it was the result of rightist conservative thinking, and accepting that he had deviated from the chairman's guiding policy. Mao's notion that mistakes made by the party should not be overemphasized, being only one finger out of 10, was enshrined in the meeting's manifesto, thus marginalizing those who had attacked the little leap forward. Zhou Enlai, whose suave, soft-spoken, slightly effeminate manners made him the ideal choice as China's foreign emissary, had a talent for landing right side up. He could be all modesty and humility when required. Before the communist victory, the nationalists used to call him Budao Weng, the Chinese name for the weighted toy tumbler that always lands upright. Early in his career as a revolutionary, Zhou had resolved never to challenge Mao. His decision was made after both had clashed in an incident that had left Mao seething with resentment. At a conference in 1932, critics of guerrilla warfare had ripped into Mao and handed command over the battlefront to Zhou instead. The result was a disaster, as a few years later nationalist troops mauled the Red Army, forcing the communists on the long march away from their base areas. In 1943, as Zhou realized that Mao's authority had become supreme, he proclaimed his undying support to the chairman. "The direction and leadership of Mao Zedong," he declared, "is the direction of the Chinese Communist Party." But Mao did not let him off the hook so easily. Zhou's loyalty was tested in a series of self-criticism meetings, in which he had to admit to his political crimes, labelling himself a political swindler who lacked principles. It was a grueling experience in self-abasement, but one from which Zhu emerged as the chairman's faithful assistant. From here onwards an uneasy and paradoxical alliance developed. Mao had to keep Zhu at bay as a potential contender for power. On the other hand, he needed him to run the show. Mao lacked interest in matters of daily routine and organizational detail, and he was often abrasive with other people. Zhu was a first-rate administrator with a knack for organization, a smooth operator skilled at forging party unity. As one biographer puts it, Mao had to draw Zhou close even as he raised the whip, and sometimes lashed the man he could not live without. The whipping did not stop at Nanning. 2 months later, in Chengdu, the final days of a party gathering were devoted to rectification seminars. But first Mao spewed disdain on the blind faith with which the planners had been following Stalin's economic path. A heavy emphasis on large industrial complexes, a sprawling apparatus of bureaucrats, and a chronically underdeveloped countryside. As early as November 1956, he had lambasted some of his colleagues for uncritically thinking that everything in the Soviet Union is perfect, that even their farts are fragrant. Creative thinking was needed to find China's own path to communism, rather than rigid adherence to Soviet methods, now frozen into socialist dogma. China should walk on two legs, simultaneously developing industry and agriculture, tackling heavy as well as light industry. And Mao, as the leader on that road, now demanded full allegiance. What is wrong with worship? The truth is in our hands. Why should we not worship it? Each group must worship its leader. It cannot but worship its leader, Mao explained. This was the correct cult of personality. The message was immediately picked up by Ke Qingxi, who quivered enthusiastically. We must have blind faith in the chairman. We must obey the chairman with total abandon. Having consecrated his own cult of personality, Mao handed over the proceedings to Liu Shaoqi, his political crony. While virtually all the participants offered self-criticisms, the situation must have been agonizing for Zhu. Both men were intensely competitive, and Liu may have seen Zhu as a threat to his prospects of taking over from the chairman. That day Liu outdid Zhu in adulation of the leader. Over the years I have felt Chairman Mao's superiority. I am unable to keep up with his thought. Chairman Mao has a remarkable knowledge, especially of Chinese history, which no one else in the party can reach. He has practical experience, especially in combining Marxist theory and Chinese reality. Chairman Mao's superiority in these aspects is something we should admire and try to learn from. Zhou, for his part, felt intense pressure to appease the chairman, who had stripped him of his authority in economic planning after Nanning. Again, he submitted a long confession about his errors, but his offerings failed to impress Mao. In May, at a formal gathering of over 1,300 people, Zhou Enlai and the party's economic czar, Chen Yun, were summoned to prepare yet another self-examination. No longer knowing what would satisfy Mao, Zhou spent days in self-imposed isolation, struggling to find the right turn of phrase. After a telephone conversation with Chen Yun, who was in a similar predicament, he sank into such dejection that his mind simply went blank. All he could do was mumble a few words followed by long silences as he stared at his secretary. That evening, late at night, his wife found him sitting slumped at his desk. Trying to help, the secretary penciled in a passage about Zhou and Mao having shared the boat through many storms. When Zhou later pored over the document, he angrily rebuked the secretary, tears welling in his eyes, accusing the man of knowing too little about party history. In the end, Zhou grovelled, lavishing praise on the chairman in front of the assembled party leaders, and telling the audience that Mao was the personification of truth, and that mistakes occurred only when the party became divorced from his great leadership. A few days after this display, Zhou handed Mao a personal letter promising to study his writings earnestly and to follow all his directives. The chairman was finally satisfied. He declared Zhou and the others to be good comrades. Zhou had saved his job. During these first months of the Great Leap Forward, Zhou was repeatedly humiliated and demeaned, but he never withdrew his support, choosing instead quietly to accept the chairman's blistering outburst in Nanning. Zhou Enlai did not have the power to overthrow his master, but he did have the planners behind him, and he could have stepped back at the cost of his career. But he had learned to accept humiliation at the hands of the chairman as a way of staying in power, albeit in his colleague's shadow. Zhou was loyal to Mao, and as a result, the many skills of the servant went to abet his master. Mao Zedong was the visionary, Zhou Enlai the midwife, who transformed nightmares into reality. Always on probation, he would work tirelessly at the Great Leap Forward to prove himself. As Zhou Enlai was debased in a spectacle of power and humiliation, other top economic officials quickly fell in line. Li Fuchun, chair of the State Planning Commission, never had to resort to self-criticism, having broken ranks with the other planners by rallying round Mao's slogans in December 1957. Chen Yun made several self-critical statements. Li Xianyan, Minister of Finance, and Bo Yibo, chair of the State Economic Commission, both opponents of the Little Leap Forward in 1956, now realized that they could not resist the tide. None dared to disagree. Li Fuchun and Li Xianyan were enlisted in the Secretariat, the inner core of the party, after they had proclaimed their allegiance to Mao. To increase the political pressure on the top echelon, the chairman also presided over a shift in power from the centre to the provinces. Nanning was the first in a series of impromptu conferences called by Mao, who strictly controlled the list of participants, set the agendas, and dominated the proceedings, allowing him to cajole his followers towards the Great Leap Forward. He brought the Secretariat to the provinces, rather than summon the provinces to come to the more formal sessions of established bodies like the State Council in Beijing. By doing so, he tapped into a deep current of dissatisfaction among provincial leaders. Tao Luqia, first secretary of Shaanxi, spoke for many local cadres when he expressed his impatience with the country's widespread poverty. Mao's vision of a China, which was poor and blank, resonated with idealists who believed in the party's capacity to catapult the country ahead of its rivals. When you are poor, you are inclined to be revolutionary. Blank paper is ideal for writing. Radical provincial leaders lapped up their leader's vision. Wu Qipu, leader of Henan, heralded a continuous revolution to crush rightist opponents and leap forward. Zheng Xisheng, long-term veteran of the People's Liberation Army and leader of Anhui, provided the slogan, "Battle hard for 3 years to change the face of China." But most of all, having witnessed the ritual abasement of their superiors on their own turf, the provinces were encouraged to launch their own witch hunts as a wind of persecution blew through the country. Mao could be cryptic, leaving his colleagues guessing at the nature of his message, but this time there was plenty of pressure from Beijing concerning the right direction. To make sure that the purges against rightist elements were carried out thoroughly, Mao sent his bull terrier, Deng Xiaoping, to a series of regional meetings. Instructions were clear. In Gansu, Deng explained, the struggle against vice-governors Sun Jiankai, Chen Chengyi, and Yang Dajun had to be unequivocal. Gansu boss Zheng Zhongliang wasted no time, and a few weeks later he announced that an anti-party clique had been uncovered inside the Party Provincial Committee. Coincidentally, its leaders were Sun Jiankai, Chen Chengyi, and Liang Dachun. they were accused of denying the achievements of the socialist high tide in 1956, attacking the party, denigrating socialism and promoting capitalism, among other heinous crimes. These were powerful leaders toppled with the support of Beijing. The purges, however, were carried out at all levels of the party, silencing most critical voices. Few dared to oppose the party line. In parts of Gansu, a poor province near the deserts of Inner Mongolia, any critical comment about grain procurement or excessive quotas simply became unthinkable. The message to party members concerned about the crop was blunt. You should consider carefully whether or not you are rightists. In Lanqiu University, located in the capital city of Gansu, up to half of all students were given a white flag, the sign of a politically conservative laggard. Some had a note pinned on their back, "Your father is a white flag." Others were beaten. Those who took a neutral stand were denounced as reactionaries. The purge continued for as long as Zheng Zongliang remained in power. By March 1960, some 190,000 people had been denounced and humiliated in public meetings, and 40,000 cadres were expelled from the party, including 150 top provincial officials. Similar purges took place throughout the country, as radical leaders seized the opportunity to get rid of their more timorous rivals. From December 1957 onwards, the southern province of Yunnan was in the grip of an anti-rightist purge that reached from party seniors down to village cadres. In April 1958, the tough local boss Si Fuqi, a short man with a double chin, announced the overthrow of the leaders of an anti-party clique. Xiong Dun and Wang Jing, the heads of the organization department, were guilty of localism, revisionism, advocating capitalism, attempting to overthrow the party's leadership, and opposing the socialist revolution. By the summer of 1958, the Inquisition had resulted in the removal of some 2,000 party members. 1 in 15 top leaders were fired, including more than 150 powerful cadres working at the county level or higher up in one of the province's dozen administrative regions. A further 9,000 party members were labelled as rightists as the campaign unfolded. Anti-party cliques were uncovered almost everywhere. Mao prodded the provincial leaders on. "Better me than you as dictator," he declared in March 1958, invoking words from Lenin. "It's similar in the provinces. Is it going to be Jiang Hua or Xia Wenhan as dictator?" In Zhejiang, Xia Wenhan was hounded by Jiang Hua, and similar battles took place in Guangdong, Inner Mongolia, Xinjiang, Gansu, Qinghai, Anhui, Liaoning, Hebei and Yunnan, among other provinces. In Hunan, one of the provinces that would be the most affected by famine, a moderate leader called Pan Fusheng was swept aside by Wu Qipu, a zealous follower of Mao. Pan had painted a grim picture of collectivization during the socialist high tide. "The peasants are the same as beasts of burden today. Yellow oxen are tied up in the house, and human beings are harnessed in the field. Girls and women pull ploughs and harrows, with their wombs hanging out. Cooperation is transformed into the exploitation of human strength." Here, it seemed, was a blatant case of a retreat to capitalism, and all of Pan's followers were hunted down, dividing party and village. Scarecrows with slogans appeared along dusty roadsides, reading "Down with Pan Fusheng" or "Down with Wu Qipu." Most local cadres could see which way the wind was blowing, and fell in line behind Wu Qipu. But however great the pressure, there were always choices to be made. When Mao toured Jiangsu and asked the local leader whether they were fighting the rightists, Jiang Weixing gathered up his courage and told the chairman that if there were any bad elements, he would have to be counted as their leader. The party should get rid of him first. Mao laughed. "You don't fear being cut in pieces for pulling the emperor off his horse? Well, just leave it then." As a result, fewer carders were denounced in Jiangsu than elsewhere. But rare were those who had the conviction, the courage, or the inclination to swim against the tide. The purges percolated down the ranks of the party. Just as Mao imposed his will in Beijing, local overlords laid down the law in their own provinces, denouncing any opposition as conservative rightism. And just as provincial capitals have their hegemons, county leaders and their cronies use the purge to eliminate their rivals. They turned a blind eye on local bullies. On the ground, a world far removed from the utopia envisaged on paper started to emerge. An early warning sign came in the summer of 1958, as a report circulating among the top brass had showed how violence had become the norm during the anti-rightist campaign in Fengxian County, just south of Shanghai. 100 people committed suicide, many others being worked to death in the fields. Wang Wenxiong, county leader, set the example with a motto that compared the masses to dogs, intimidated only by the sight of a stick in a carder's hands. Thousands of villagers were accused of being landlords or counter-revolutionaries in public meetings that punctuated daily life for months on end. Many were routinely beaten, tied up and tortured, some being carried away to special labor camps set up throughout the county. Fengxian was a dire warning of the darkness to come. At the top, however, floating far above the ground, faith in the ability of the people to change heaven and earth was boundless. In December 1957, Chen Xiongren, one of Mao's most trusted colleagues, attacked the conservatism of rightists who hampered the enthusiasm of the masses in the Water Conservancy campaign. This was the rallying cry of the Great Leap Forward. Chapter 4. Bugle Call. A muddy river runs through the heart of China, flowing some 5,500 kilometers from the barren mountains in Qinghai to empty into the Bohai Sea, the innermost gulf of the Yellow Sea near Beijing. The upper reaches of the river flow through mountain valleys where the water is clear, but after a series of steep cliffs and gorges, it meanders through the dusty Loess Plateau, picking up the soft, silty sediment left behind over time by wind storms. As mud and sand are further discharged into the river, it turns into a dirty ochre colour. The Loess is deposited in the slower sections downstream, causing the riverbed to rise. By the time it passes the ancient city of Kaifeng, the riverbed runs 10 meters above the surrounding fields. When the banks burst, the flat northern plain is easily inundated, turning the river into one of the most perilous natural hazards on record. Kaifeng itself was flooded, abandoned, and rebuilt several times. Ditches and embankments were traditionally used as flood defenses, but they had little effect, the river carrying an estimated 1.6 billion tons of silt annually. When the Yellow River flows clear, in Chinese, is the equivalent of the expression, when pigs fly. Another traditional saying heralds the advent of a miraculous leader. When a great man emerges, the Yellow River will run clear. Could Chairman Mao tame the river that flooded so often that it had earned the name China's Sorrow? Early propaganda posters showed him sitting pensively on a rock overlooking the river, perhaps pondering ways to clear the water. In 1952, when these photos were taken, Mao had toured the river and uttered a single, somewhat cryptic line, "Work on the Yellow River must be carried out well." Heated debates about the scheme ensued among engineers while Mao remained on the sidelines, and a faction in favor of a large dam finally prevailed. Soviet experts, themselves enamored with gigantic projects, surveyed the lower reach and identified the Three-Gate Gorge in Henan as a suitable site. A design for a dam setting the normal pool water at 360 meters was delivered in April 1956, meaning that close to 1 million people would have to be relocated as some 220,000 hectares of land would be submerged. The project was officially launched in April 1957, despite the reservations of several hydraulic engineers. Huang Wan Li, an American-trained geologist who had visited every major dam in the United States, argued that dire consequences would follow from the attempt to clear the river of sediment. Blocking dirt and loess behind a giant dam would limit the reservoir's lifespan and eventually lead to disaster. Then Mao intervened. "What is this trash?" was the angry headline of his editorial published in June 1957 by the People's Daily. The article listed a series of charges against Huang, alleging, among other things, that he had attacked the chairman, harmed the party, propagated bourgeois democracy, and admired foreign cultures. All criticism of the Three Gate Gorge Dam was brushed aside. By the end of 1958, the Yellow River was blocked. Some 6 million square meters of earth had been moved in a pharaonic enterprise involving the labor of tens of thousands of villagers. A year later, the dam was ready. The water was clear. But the initial design had provided for several outlets and tubes, allowing accumulated sediment to be flushed through the dam. These had been blocked by reinforced concrete in the haste to complete the project on schedule. Within a year, the sediment started inching upstream, raising the waters and threatening to flood the industrial center of Xi'an. Extensive rebuilding was required to purge the sediment, which in turn caused a drop in the pool level. With a lower waterline, the 150,000 kilowatt turbines, installed at great cost, became completely useless and had to be removed to another site. The water was no longer clear. By 1961, the amount of silt carried by the Yellow River had doubled, Zhou Enlai himself admitted. Up to 95% of a section of the Yellow River west of Zhengzhou consisted of mud. A few years later, the area was so silted up that foreigners were banned from visiting the dam. The term Great Leap Forward was first used in the context of the Water Conservancy Drive launched towards the end of 1957. Determined to overtake Britain in 15 years, Mao saw a key to rapid industrialization in the substitution of labor for capital. The masses were the country's real wealth, and they should be mobilized during the slack winter season before the spring plowing to transform the countryside. If water could be diverted to irrigate the thin topsoil of the many impoverished villages strewn across the arid north, if floods could be contained with giant dikes and reservoirs in the subtropical south, the yield of grain would jump. All over China, tens of millions of farmers joined irrigation projects. Collectively, so the propaganda went, they could accomplish in a matter of months what their forefathers had done in thousands of years. Some 30 million people were recruited in October 1957. By January, one in six people was digging earth in China. More than 580 million cubic meters of rocks and soil were moved before the end of the year. Henan, where the Three Gate Gorge Dam was being built, took the lead, as local boss Wu Qipu ruthlessly pushed the labor force into grandiose projects designed to impress Beijing. In the region bordering Hunan and Anhui, center of an ambitious Harness the Huai River campaign, which would unfold for several decades, more than 100 dams and reservoirs were built between 1957 and 1959. In a country in the grip of gigantism, massive irrigation schemes appeared everywhere, although the leadership gave special emphasis to the northwest. Critical voices were few and far between. Mao distrusted intellectuals, and in the summer of 1957 persecuted hundreds of thousands of those who had dared to voice a critical opinion during the Hundred Flowers. But as we have seen in the previous chapter, the purge of party leaders in the anti-rightist campaign from late 1957 onwards was even more effective in removing opposition to the Great Leap Forward. In Gansu province, for instance, senior leaders such as Sun Jianchai and Liang Dajun were denounced as the heads of an anti-party clique and expelled in February 1958. One of the accusations